Hello and welcome to the Project Elected podcast. Project Elect is a nonpartisan nonprofit whose goal is pretty simple. We want to get more Latter-day Saint women involved in public service. On this podcast, we interview amazing Latter-day Saint women who are involved in public service. My name is Audrey Perry Martin. I'm the founder of Project Elect and the host of this podcast. Before we get started today, I did want to point out that the filing period for running for local office in California goes until August 12th. So now is the time to run or recruit someone to run if you live in the Golden State. So today I'm so excited to be interviewing Rebecca Casper. She is the three-time mayor of Idaho Falls, Idaho, and just a delightful person. I've really enjoyed chatting with her today. So this is going to be a lot of fun. We're going to have a great interview, and we've got a lot of cool things and insights to share. So Rebecca, thank you so much for being here today. Would you introduce yourself?
Sure. My name is Rebecca Casper. I serve as the mayor of the city of Idaho Falls. As we've talked about, my family is dear to me. I have four grown children. They're all either in school or working or a combination of the two. I claim Arizona as my home state. My family moved around an awful lot when I was little, but Arizona was sort of where I went to junior high and high school, and my mother and sister are still there. We were a family of five girls, and three of my sisters are gone, and different reasons and they're all heartbreaks because I'm the oldest, and I can only imagine how my mom feels surviving her children, but for me to survive my younger sisters, it's definitely had an impact on the way I think and some empathy that I'm able to have that I wouldn't have had otherwise. But anyway, I am divorced. That's a regret. I've already started off being emotional, and I apologize, but being divorced is, it was another one of those life-changing kind of experiences where at the time I felt like I had just utterly failed. And it took me a while to realize that that was a moment in time that I had to learn from. And again, it's given me a lot of empathy, given me a lot of freedom in some ways, because I've been able to pursue this office and serve in this office without having to factor in, a second career in our home. And that maybe has been, maybe I've been a little bit unfettered in that way, but it doesn't mean that I don't long for the day when I can share my life again with somebody. But that definitely was a life-changing kind of experience. And it gave me the kick in the pants, maybe, to get to start putting my money where my mouth was in terms of being a political science major for undergrad and having a PhD in political science. I have always believed in public service and always believed in being involved. But when I was married and mothering my kids, my involvement was, hey, I vote and hey, I maybe write a letter and I pay attention to the news and I volunteer at the school. And that was the extent of it. But divorce forced me to sort of have to decide, okay, what am I going to be now that I'm grown up? And it was it opened a door, even though another one closed. So life teaches you a lot of things. Somebody said it, and then John Lennon mused about it. But, life is what happens when you're making other plans. That's definitely true. And I think that's part of how Heavenly Father keeps us on our toes and helps us to learn.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Well, thank you for sharing that. You've had a lot of incredible life experiences that I clearly brought you to this point today. So I do want to ask you, because you know, you're talking about the different things you've been through and hard things that you've been through, and how that kind of helped you prepare for what you're doing now and skills and emotions and just growth that you had. And tell me a little bit about that. What do you think helped prepare you? Why do you think you're a better elected official now because of the some of the pain you've been through?
you know, I hadn't expected that we'd go this direction, but I will tell you that I think empathy really matters. When someone comes to you as an elected official, or maybe appears in a council meeting during the public, you know, comment period, or when someone writes to you and they are clearly coming from an experience that was difficult for them, you are able to hear it differently than if your life has been all sunshine and roses. Just last night, we had a public testimony in a hearing. Several folks, in fact, talked about their concerns about traffic over a proposed development that the council was had to consider approving. And one council member said, well, you know, just because I have two cars, doesn't mean that everybody does. She said, I was actually surprised to learn that in this part of our community, the number of people who own two cars is only about maybe 60%, and everyone else owns one or none. And so we can't, immediately jump to the conclusion that traffic is going to be what we think it would be if everybody were like us, you know. And so I do think that's a silly example, maybe, but I think that it's important for us to have empathy and be able to step outside of our own experiences. And that's hard to do when you haven't struggled, maybe. Mm-hmm. Maybe.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I definitely feel that the hard experiences in my life have helped me gain empathy, and you just see people from a different perspective if you've had struggles and trials and bad things happen to you. And so I appreciate you sharing that. I did want to ask you a little bit about Idaho Falls, because I know a lot of our listeners know about Idaho Falls, but I'd love to hear a little bit more about your city.
All right, I'll give you my little spiel.
Okay.
Idaho Falls is the largest city in eastern Idaho. And you go west of or east of Boise, and we're the biggest. We have, but that means what, roughly 70,000 people. So some people in California are probably, you know, laughing right now. That's a big city in Idaho. We're the fourth largest, and kind of proud of it. But when it comes to city governance, we are every bit as complicated, if not more so, than even the largest city in our state. And all the others, because we provide more hardcore government services than those other cities do. Maybe not on the volume as say Boise, Idaho, which is our capital, but we have a power utility that generates power that gives us a lot of complexity and a lot of regulatory awareness and hoops we have to jump through. We have an airport, which has grown incredibly in the last little while, and we've had to become a lot more sophisticated about the FAA and understanding, you know, air travel in this country. We do all of our curb and gutter sidewalk drainage, all of those things that in the Boise area, they have a separate governmental entity that handles that. So local government doesn't have to worry about that. We do our own, we have six utilities. We provide fiber to the home. We're just involved in an awful lot. We are the most complex government in the state. Mm-hmm. Consequently, we employ a lot more people than most of our city governments. I have 11 departments, and none of them are fluffy like arts and culture, which Boise has that department. And fluffy is maybe an offensive term for some. I don't mean that arts and culture are not important, but we don't have the luxury of a department that just does these cool things. We are all pretty hardcore in our departments, but there are 11 of them that report to me. And so it's a busy, complex governance experience serving in Idaho Falls. Mm-hmm. We're here on the Snake River in a beautiful part of the country where we still have wide open space. You can get to some beautiful skiing and outdoor experiences, whether it's to Sun Valley, Idaho, or Island Park, Idaho, or Jackson Hole, Wyoming. Within an hour to 2 hours, you can be in an entirely different place. And so we have a lot of outdoor enthusiasts who like to be here. Fiber to the home means that people move here and can have that flexible lifestyle of working from home, but being able to be where they want to be. You can work here in the city of Idaho Falls and take off during your lunch hour and within 10 minutes find your kid's soccer game. It may take you five more to find a parking place, but, you know, and get to the field and watch your child. There's no commute headache to speak of, although people do complain if it takes 15 minutes to drive across town. We don't know how good we have it here, but this is a really beautiful place. No air pollution issues. We have wind, but it blows away anything that we don't want to breathe. It's just a great place to live. Mm-hmm. Great, wholesome place.
Yeah. Yeah. I love that. And I'm sure you guys are growing just like all of Idaho right now, with a lot of people wanting to move there and live there because they see how great of a place it is.
Sadly, we've seen housing just skyrocket. You know, my recollection is 3 years ago, my property value was about $199,000 or $200,000. And, you know, it's easily doubled, if not 2.5 times that. And that's created some difficulty for the people who live here, because not only has property increased, but inflation has driven up the price of the cost of living. And it used to be we were under, and now we are above many national norms for a time. And that's difficult. Yeah. And then the valuation of property, the way that it is you know, skyrocketing, it has certainly impacted property valuation for property tax purposes. And in Idaho, local government, just about every government except state relies on property tax. And that makes it really, really difficult for many people right now.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, let's talk a little bit about public service. And you've got a really interesting background in public service and kind of how you came to it. So I wanted to ask you about your education experiences and your background experiences and what kind of led you to run for public office, and if that was something you were always planning or if it kind of just happened.
Man, there's a long answer and a short answer. I'm going to try to maybe mush them together.
Okay.
But, you know, all of my life, I've thought getting involved was cool. I remember we lived for a short time. We lived in Dayton, Ohio, and I went to the first third of third grade there. And in our third grade class, Mrs. Studebaker told us that we could elect a president to be a part of the school's student council. Now, how serious can an elementary school student council be? But man, I was so excited. I ran to be class president, got elected, got to go to one student council meeting before we moved. And I remember I had to, you know, turn it over to the runner-up, this really cute boy named Roger. And I, you know, Roger, you get to be class president now. And I never really got to do anything. But sixth grade, I ran for class president then, and I won. And that was, you know, again, 25, 26 kids voting for you. What do you do? But it was still, somehow that was important to me. Then we moved that was in Oklahoma. We moved to Phoenix, Arizona, and I thought, well, this is what I like to do. So I ran for seventh grade vice president in my middle school, bigger stakes, 500 kids or whatever. And I won, new girl won, and loved it. Had the best student council advisor, great experiences. I was eighth grade class president. Freshman year, you get to high school, I lost. Oh, I remember still to this day when they were announcing it over the loudspeaker at the last period of, you know, the last 10 minutes of the school day, and my face just went a hot flush when I wasn't announced. And that was probably one of the best things that ever happened to me, because it really taught me humility, and it helped me to see, you know, student government from a different perspective. I still volunteered and worked on the float and all those things you do. And then I went on to, didn't run for president again. I ran for vice president in 9th grade or 10th grade and 11th grade. 12th grade, you could either be a class officer or a student body officer. And I ran for student body president, and I won. But I have to tell you, I only had one opponent. His name was Glenn. And Glenn got disqualified because of his grades. And so I ran unopposed. That's not really a victory. you know, poor Glenn, he was a popular guy. And so I didn't revel in that victory. I felt almost embarrassed, but I loved being in student government, loved it. And we put on a leadership camp for the, you know, junior high student body officers. And we tried to, you know, teach leadership and build school spirit and do all those things you do. Got to BYU and ran for student body office there. Back then, It's very different now, organized very differently, but back then it was the Associated Students of BYU. And I served as the Vice President of Community Services. And boy, what that was fantastic, because we were all about volunteerism and creating student opportunities for service in the community. And I got to work with the United Way, got to learn more about nonprofits and volunteers and how students were important, but how volunteers were important, really formed a strong conviction at that time in my life of how much could be accomplished by people who were not paid to do something, and how important it was to thank them and to recognize them and to involve them in, the organization. Mm-hmm. So that's the long answer. I've always been involved and loved governance and loved the things that you could do to shape your environment, whether it was a classroom, campus, or a community. Mm-hmm. But the shorter answer is that most women on their path to public service, they don't jump right in. They're not that third grader who thinks, I can do that. Most women, for whatever social reasons or biological ones, we don't step up and say, yeah, I'm the best person for the job. We have to be invited. We have to be coaxed and cajoled. The Center for the Advancement of Women in Politics at Rutgers University, COP, C-A-W-P, has done a lot of research about women in politics. And on average, women have to be invited 3 or 4 times. And I was no exception. I was here, already divorced, volunteering, attending chamber meetings. I served as the legislative, vice chair for, and then the chair for the legislative committee of the chamber. Really easy to do those things because nobody steps up and volunteers in some organizations. So it's super easy to get involved. But that led me to be on some people's radar. I worked on the previous mayor's campaign, and people, called me when they knew he wasn't running again and they knew city elections were coming up, and asked if I would run on a Tuesday. And they wanted me to run for for city council. And city council here pays, back then it was paying maybe $850 a month or something. And can't support your family on that. On Thursday, somebody else said, you should run. You should run. I said, and I need to support my family. I can't do it. On Saturday, 2 attorneys took me to breakfast, and they were a little more persistent, and they wanted me not to run for student or for city council, but for mayor. Mm-hmm. And I left that meeting having made a promise to them, and that is that I would ask my children. And I did. And my kids said, go for it, Mom. I mean, there was no hesitation, none whatsoever. And so then I thought about it, and I thought, okay, wait a minute. I'm teaching some classes at BYU Idaho. I was an adjunct professor at the time, and I thought, if I run, I will have the best campaigns and finance, campaign finance, and I will have the best lecture because it'll be informed not just by knowledge, but also by experience. Mm-hmm. And then I thought, and if I win, then I have another experience coming my way either way. So it's a win-win. Therefore, I can do this, and I don't lose. There's no downside. So I jumped in, and those same 2 attorneys, plus a few others, are friends to this day who really, really helped make a difference and got to help me make a campaign. So.
Yeah. That's such a great story. And I love the story of third grade Rebecca wanting to run and then running every single time she could after that. That's fantastic. It's in your blood, it sounds like.
Yeah, it's really not ego. It's more, I want to do that. It's different motivation.
Yeah. You want to help. You want to, third graders don't have much of an ego. Want to be involved, want to help, want to serve. And that's fantastic. That's the reason why we want our elected officials to be doing the job, is because they want to help. So what do you think makes a good public servant?
Well, I will tell you, I have 2 different kinds of answers to that. I have the opportunity from time to time to talk to young women, students, groups, and things like that. And I will say that it's one of the things that makes a good public servant is someone who's knowledgeable. Mm-hmm. You have to come into the experience knowing things. You have to understand what infrastructure is out, all about and what those challenges are. You have to know the difference between government funds and enterprise funds and how those are managed differently. You know, you really need to have some understanding. It's even better if you have a foundation in economics or at least understand statistics, understand, you know, how the media operates and why it's important and why the media isn't an enemy to, you know, to politics, but in fact, you know, one of our very best friends. And so those, all of those kinds of things are super important to understand. But I found myself early on engaging in a lot of conversation with people who were angry and cynical. And I set a goal for myself, and that is that my service in the city of Idaho Falls was, my biggest goal was to make sure that we serve our citizens so well that we will preserve or restore confidence in local government. I want their daily lives to be smoother and easier and not impeded by worries about local governance. And that sets a really high bar for city officials and staff. But by and large, for someone who carefully observes, we meet that. All it takes is one nasty letter or one accusation that's not accurate that can really set us back from that goal, because people become cynical almost by default. That seems to be a posture that a lot of folks will adopt now. And it's driven by frustrations at the national level or state level. I never want citizens to feel angst about their government, though. And I often say that cynicism and anger are no basis for governance. And I really, really believe that. I don't think you make good decisions in anger. And I don't think you make good decisions when you're working against the very structure that's supposed to govern. And governing is not evil. It's not man's law. It's important. The rule of law is important. So and I got off track here. But anyway, there's my answer.
Yeah, that's great. Why do you think that more Latter-day Saint women don't run for office? What do you think's holding them back?
You know, we go through our socialization, maybe in the church, thinking that to be a good Latter-day Saint woman, well, back in my day, and I'm a little older than you are, and a lot older, probably. Maybe I could be your mom. I'm 59 years old, and when I was young, it was, you learn sewing and you learn kitchen skills so that you can, you know, cook and bake for your family and you know, be thrifty and make a home where you save money and you sew for your family and you know these things. And thankfully, some of that has been dropped from our, you know, list of things we have to be good at. But I think that we think that we are supposed to have children and stay home. And if we don't somehow do either of those things really well, that we are failing in our role as women in the kingdom of God. And being divorced is one of those things that woke me up, shook me awake. And I realized, you know what, I don't have to define myself by that, because if I define myself by the perfect family, I will be a failure by definition for the rest of my life. And that is not what Heavenly Father wants for us. And I feel that very, very strongly. He wants us to be strong and beautiful and speak out and lead out in the ways that we can that are unique and different from the ways that our male counterparts can lead. He wants us to have confidence in who we are as his children. And it takes all voices and all perspectives. Mm-hmm. So I think Latter-day Saint women sometimes maybe are held back by their buy-in to cultural norms that aren't necessarily supported by doctrine, and they're not necessarily part of what I think is what our Heavenly Father's vision is for us. But not a one of us who has children wants our children to grow up to fit into a little mold. We want our children to blossom, and just as each petal of a blossom unfolds like a rose, we want them to turn into whoever they're supposed to be. And our Father in Heaven wants the same for us, I believe. And so I hope that Latter-day Saint women will get rid of some of those fetters I talked about and just, you know, step up and step out and lead.
Yeah. I really like that. Did you notice any issues or impediments to running because you were a woman?
I am proud to, as I reflected on that before we talked, I have to tell you that I'm proud to say that this community did not play the divorce card against me. They did not ask me, you know, how are you going to take care of your kids? You know, none of that stuff came out. This was a very issue-oriented experience that I've had. But in preparation for worrying about that, I did have a conversation with my ex-husband, who does live here in town, and he was willing to say the right kinds of things to help people not draw inappropriate conclusions if he had to. He was willing to, you know, defend that. And I thought that's nice, that we were able to have that level of communication and support for each other. But it was also, it reflects well on this community that we didn't go there with the woman running for office thing.
That's fantastic. I love that your community didn't do that and didn't go, you know, get dirty and do the negative ads and all of those kind of things that we see in campaigns way, way too often. And that's heartening that there are still campaigns.
It leave the wrong impression. We've had our share of negative campaigns. It hasn't been based on
gender. It hasn't been personal based, gender based.
There was a Casper campaign, anti-campaign in my second election. And that was fueled by outside money, and it was fueled by folks who, you know, they want somebody who's under their partisan thumb.
Yeah.
And I have to tell you that nonpartisanship is a gift. Not every state in this country has nonpartisan local. That movement for nonpartisanship came out of the progressive era of politics, which was itself a reaction to the machine politics era in politics in this country.
Yeah.
And nonpartisanship, that you tend to see that then in states that came online, you know, in the 1890s and the early 1900s. And you know, so the West tends to be more nonpartisan. And that is a gift, because we don't have to be under any party leader's thumb. We get to make decisions for our community that are the right ones for our community, with only our community's needs in mind. And not having to serve a party master is super important, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know a lot about political history because you have a PhD in political science. I did want to ask you about that and kind of how that came to be. And you know, it's just so interesting to talk to women about their educational decisions and experiences. And I'd love to hear your story about that.
Well, I went to BYU as a political science major. For about 15 minutes, I changed that to an international relations major because I kind of fell in love with the Kennedy Center and all the cool things that happened there. But I changed back to political science. And then, somewhere along the line, I thought I was pre-law. And then I took a constitutional law class from Dean Hickman at BYU back in the day. And in that con law class, I learned, you know, a lot about how basic constitutional rights, you know, came to be. And almost every right that we have that isn't, you know, enumerated in the Bill of Rights or the Constitution is something that has come about through case law. And so you read and learn about these cases, and then you think, I thought, I can't be a lawyer and defend guilty people when, you know, somehow that class made me think that I couldn't be a lawyer. And so, because I didn't understand the breadth of law, and at the time I didn't have a very sophisticated understanding of case law and how it was developed and how it's applied and all of that. So I thought, well, crud, what am I going to do if I'm not going to go to law school? And at the time, there was a professor in the department, Dr. Gary Briner. And Dr. Briner has passed away, and he died far, way, way too young. But that man was so humble and was so service oriented. And he always made me feel like I was smart. And one time I worked in the department as an assistant, and he pulled me aside and he said that he had some research and would I be interested in doing some research for him. And that blew me away. I thought, wow. Ooh, I never thought about doing that. And it gave me so much confidence. And I've since learned, in fact, it was just yesterday, but the stats show that someone who does research in their undergrad years is much more likely to go on and work in, you know, that field or go on for graduate study. And so through that experience of doing research, I thought, okay, maybe I'm not the one to challenge policy in the courts, but maybe I can be the one to help inform good policy through good research. And working with Dr. Briner led me to then applying for the master's program at BYU, and then I went through that, and then that was going to be the end. But then I got married to someone who ended up going to UC Berkeley Law School, and after working on campus and trying to be the wife who was bringing in, you know, money to buy groceries while my spouse was in law school, I thought, I can go to school too. And so I applied to their political science program, which was a very good program, and I was very fortunate to get in, and suddenly became a student again, and worked through their political science PhD program, graduated with my third child in my, in utero, chubby, pregnant, walking across that stage, but I was so proud to be a mom in grad school and to set that example for some of my peers in school that you could be a parent and be a student. Anyway, great experiences.
That's fantastic. That's how do you feel like that educational experience has helped you as you've, run for elected office and manage the city and all of these things?
Well, I will say that, as I mentioned maybe earlier, city government here is fascinating. It's complex. We've got scientists testing the water at the water treatment plant, and looking for the composition of do we have the right mix of bacteria and whatever, right? So we've got people in lab coats working for the city. At the same time, we've got people who are, visioning what's our energy future going to be like, and where are we with, our portfolio for energy, and do we have, realistic goals when it comes to being carbon free, and where are we with our electric vehicle deployment? And we've got people then who are working on the cutting edge of what it means to be a police officer today in this country. It's very different and very difficult than it was just a decade ago. Mm-hmm. Politics is one thing that swirls, but so does the need for really good and informed policy. And when you have government, city government, that is managed by lay people, right? All of us electeds who don't have expertise in these fields, we have to be open to and understand and be willing to give credence to the professionalism that we're surrounded by and the professionals that we hire. We have to give them enough rope so they can really swing out and do a great job. Mm-hmm. And so my education has helped me to value everybody else's education that I work with. And it's helped me to maybe be able to find those common themes in each department of, the need for leadership, the need for policy processes that give us good results. And so I'm not sure if I'm making a lot of sense, but it has helped. And then just understanding, like I mentioned earlier, the role of media. I don't view the newspaper asking questions as a negative. If they uncover something that is a flaw, it's embarrassing, but it's not a reason to get upset. It's a reason to get to work, because I want to be able to pass the white glove test, or put anything we do under a microscope. We better be able to defend our decisions, and so I welcome my media presence. Interestingly enough, it's diminished over the time I've been in office.
Really?
Newspapers have less clout, local newspapers, than they used to. Many of them struggle. Some of them that used to be dailies have gone to fewer days, or maybe they become weeklies. And what we end up with then are fewer journalists out there who really understand the need to corroborate, information and have good storytelling skills that where they vet their information. A lot of people are getting their news now from sources that they self-select and that often are not put through the filter of good journalism. And that's something that I think we're still in our infancy as a people when it comes to trying to get good information to us. We're flooded with information, and we haven't developed the skills. We don't have a class at school yet that teaches you how do you filter all that information that the web and the immediacy of our communication, right? How do we filter all of it? And we haven't learned that yet.
Yeah.
So.
And it is very important, as we've seen. It's that is one of the things I care a lot about. Is I was a journalism undergrad, and I very much care about, you know, the media and how it has kind of, it's very difficult to filter the information. So that influences politics certainly a lot. Well, let's talk a little bit about your run for office and how that went, because a lot of the women who listen to this podcast are considering running for office. And so I always like to ask a few questions about your campaign and how you first started your campaign. You told us a little bit about how you were encouraged to run, but how did the campaigning go?
Campaigning was actually kind of easy if I tell you that it felt like teaching. It always feels like teaching. I have to be careful not to get on a soapbox, and I would have my, you know, campaign helpers say, you know, don't share all the details the way that you want to when you're teaching a class. But most definitely, you can create those aha moments for people when you give them some background information to help them understand the context that we're in, you know, really important decisions are being made. So I enjoyed campaigning, but I think I have to learn. I haven't learned yet to speak in sound bites. If you can't tell, I mostly just talk until I'm done explaining something. Most of the time, people don't want to hear that. They want to hear the 1 minute or the 10 second version. And I haven't learned that yet, but the talking to people is great. Campaign events where you have 30 seconds to summarize your opinion on something, that's harder for me because I really always want to get background because it's important. And if we allow ourselves, I think, to just think that government is 30 second explanations, we do ourselves a huge disservice. So we have to find that balance, but that's the struggle for me. Going back to campaigning, I benefited from so many good people. It's humbling and frightening, because frightening in the sense that I will never be able to pay them back for believing in me and spending their precious time helping me to put together good strategy just practicing debating or helping me to identify which neighborhoods are the ones we need to target or which addresses need a mailer. That knowledge and those skills that I've been able to benefit from others. My patriarchal blessing says that I am the product of a sharing of love. And that's just a little snippet of a phrase. But boy, has that really come true when I think about all the folks who've been a part of campaigns. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. What advice would you give someone who's considering running for office?
There's, I guess, the substance advice. And I've maybe alluded to some of it, the substance advice about understanding what, if you're considering running for office, define what office it is. If it's city, if it's school board, if it's the fire district, if it's state, county, whatever it is, find out what they do. Find out what their meat and potatoes are, and make sure that you understand, you know, some of the big picture there. Ask some questions, find out a little bit about the finance structure and the governance structure so that you really develop opinions on that and are able to know why it is that you think you can contribute there, right? You've got to do that research. And but let me tell you two other things. Another piece of advice is that it's really important to get involved and to volunteer. And that is so easy. It is so easy. It can be as simple as thinking, okay, wait a minute. I'm interested in state government, and this person from my part of the state is running for this office. I kind of think they're good at it, or I kind of think I support them. Go to their website, look things up, and then, darn it, get the email address for either the candidate or the manager, and send an email saying, I'd like to work for you. I believe in what you, you know, are running on your platform. How can I help? What can I do? Instantly, things will start happening. You will become a part of that kind of an effort very quickly. Nobody turns volunteers down who are sincere and who have something to offer. So get involved. Here in the city of Idaho Falls, if you want to get involved, we have over 25 boards, committees, and commissions that are citizen-based. You can Google that on our city's website, and it comes up, you submit an application, and you turn it in, checking the boxes for all the different committees that you're interested in, and you will get some kind of a response and a phone call. It is really, really easy to get involved. And then finally, I will say to all the women out there who need an invitation, who need a nudge, let this podcast be your first nudge. And every single, episode that you've done, Audrey, has some incredible advice. Let your second nudge be me saying, I believe very strongly that, how did one professor of mine put it? That we need to be the music, our morality needs to be the music of hope for this planet. The gathering of Israel can't happen if we don't step outside of our comfort zones and be good examples and sound those notes of truth, of integrity, and be examples of being energetic and be willing to do what needs to be, the work that needs to be done. If we don't do that, then we're not contributing what we have. Another maxim that you hear in the church is where much is given, much is required. I could not believe that more if I tried. I came from pretty humble beginnings. And I still have insecurities surrounding, is my future secure enough? And but I will tell you that if I could go back today and talk to myself 30 years ago and just say, it's going to be good, it's going to be fine, and just try to remove those insecurities from myself, I think I would, I'm getting off on a tangent here, Audrey, that you didn't ask for, but I think that fear and worry, which are insecurities, those things get in our way so much. And so let me see if I can go back to where I need to be. I want to be able to encourage the women who may be considering running that there's nothing to be afraid of. Not a thing, not a darn thing, because in the end, our faithfulness, our willingness to serve, we may not end up serving in the exact way that we envision, but that will be rewarded, and because it's needed by our Father in heaven. He didn't go to read the Old Testament as we're doing in Sunday school right now. He did not go to the kings of the day, unless maybe you think maybe Cyrus, right? We just learned about Cyrus and how important he was. But for the most part, he went to the humble. He went to the shepherds, and he went to the Davids, not the Goliaths. He went for the young people or the people who were humble. And so women, if you're feeling too humble to serve, remember that be careful, because that's exactly the person Father in Heaven needs to step up. So you are being called. And then finally, have the courage to know that when you are doing something good, no matter how cynical you might be about government and this world, there are people who are willing to support good. They will stick to it like a magnet. So be who you are, shine your light, and it will make a difference.
That was an amazing invitation. Thank you. Thank you so much. I appreciate that. And I love so much of what you said. And especially that last part about people will stick to the good like a magnet. That's so true. And in our cynical world, it's so important to remember that. Well, Rebecca, it has been such a pleasure talking to you. We are unfortunately out of time, but I appreciate you doing this. I appreciate you taking the time for us and talking with us. And it's just been a delight to get to know you a little bit and hear all your words of wisdom. So thank you so much.
Thank you for this opportunity, and good luck to you as you find amazing voices to highlight on this program so that you can encourage and inspire people.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Thanks.